My name is Stephanie. I'm a mom, a grandmom, a co-parent, a co-grandparent. I love hiking. I love music. I love lyrics because they're lyrics and poetry from people's hearts. And I love being outdoors and going for walks on trails. It's my sacred ground. My early life was a life of chaos. It was quite dark. My parents loved us, but they were not a good mix. They fought all the time. And I would find hiding places when I was young in the house. And then eventually that would change into trails and parks in the small town that I grew up in. As we moved along, by my teen years, I was really persuaded by my uncle, who was a very strong atheist, and really adopted his sort of thunderstorm of arguments because he looked powerful to me. One of those moments was standing up in my class in grade six and announcing to everybody that at Christmas time that there's no such thing as God. And then one of the arguments that really stuck with me was the idea that there is nothing after you die. I was really wrestling with that question as a teenager, and a lot of other things and a lot of other moments in my life where I learned different things than what my uncle taught me. And I was just, it was all kind of mixing around in my heart and stuff. And there was a park close to where I lived that I would go to. And one day, I think I was 17, I can't remember exactly. And I was just looking out over the mountains and the trees and everything that was there and the details and all of that. And I knew in that moment, God had to exist. I just knew it. It was an epiphany of sorts. So that carried on into my adult life where I was going to build a family that was different than I experienced as a child. I call it my Little House on the Prairie family. And but it was done in my own strength, self-determined. I believed in God, but I didn't know God. And that family ended up falling apart as well. So then I was in a time of a lot of pressure, a single parenthood pressure of finances, of kids. We did have a very good co-parenting relationship, but I just was burdened. And a client of mine started chatting when I would cut his hair. I was a hairstylist, and he had liked to do these deep talks of life, and I was like that. And so we would talk about life, and I found out that he was a Christian, and he invited me to church, and I started going. And for months long, I went through a pretty severe battle between these cliches that I learned growing up were really at war against what I was hearing in church. And I thankfully had this person to process all of that. And I started reading a Bible and another book that I was reading at the time about a guy who was an atheist and went to investigate Jesus and discovered it was true. And so after those many months, I knew that this was true. I was convinced that this was true and I needed to give my life over to the Lord. Then from there on, it's just been the most amazing discovery and, you know, just that love that God has for us that's so different than anything that I ever knew as a person and totally different from me. So I was like, yeah, I want more of this. I want to know more. I still say that 20 years later. There's still more to know. Christmas in Jesus means that something new has been born, planted in the earth that changes everything for everyone forever. It's important that we remember and celebrate this every year because it is so profound.
Hello, my name is Kirsten, and I'm one of the pastors here at Living Waters, and it's always so good to be with you. Christmas is coming, as I'm sure that you've noticed. At our house, the biggest physical indication that Christmas is on its way is the very beautiful, but also very wide Christmas tree that we got from the Bart's Tree Farm a few weeks ago. I think it would look really good in a living room about twice the size of ours, because no matter where you sit in our living room, you can't escape the presence of the tree. We are spending time this month in the grand sweeping prologue that begins John's biography of Jesus. This introduction has none of the classic elements of the Christmas story. There is no Mary, no Joseph, no baby even. But what it tells us about Jesus is central to our understanding of who he is. It's as unavoidable as the giant fir in my living room. Because John shows us who Jesus is, not just as a person, but as God. Both Matthew and Luke tell the circumstances of Jesus' birth. The angels, the shepherds, the stable, the unwed teenage mother. But because these accounts had already been written, John had the freedom to write something different. At the end of his biography, John tells us that he wrote what he did, that we may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. You can see this intention so clearly in John's prologue. He wants us to see exactly who and what Jesus is. He wants to make it completely clear that the subject of his biography is God. There's no wiggle room for him to be anything else. As Luke shared with us a few weeks ago, we are given a picture of Jesus in this prologue that is more cosmic than the endless universe we inhabit. Jesus is described by John as the Word, a term that would have held meaning for both the Jewish people and those in the broader Greco-Roman first century world. A Greek reading John 1, would have seen the Word as the source of reason that both gives shape and order to the universe and gives humanity its rational thinking soul. And a Jew, reading John 1, would have seen the Word as God in action, creating, delivering, revealing himself. And that's exactly what we see the Word doing in the beginning of John 1. He was with God in the beginning. He is the primary mover in creation. John gives us here a dramatic reframing of the creation story that we find in Genesis, revealing something that the writer of Genesis didn't know, that the primary creator and maker was the subject of John's biography, the Word. As he moves to verse 14, he gets to the climax of his entire prologue. The declaration that would have been the most shocking and difficult for his audience to either understand or accept. He says that the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word became flesh. It's difficult for us to really wrap our heads around how incomprehensible it would have been for John's contemporaries to grasp this statement that the Word had become flesh. I remember when I was in my early 20s reading church history for the first time, and what I discovered was it took a long time for the church to figure out just what it meant that Jesus was both fully human and fully God. Many people came up with alternate ideas that came to be called heresies because their beliefs diminished either Jesus' humanity or his divinity. It's almost as if this truth that Jesus is both is a path on the top of a narrow ridge and people are falling off of it on either side. It took a few hundred years for the church to settle into the uncomfortable orthodoxy that Jesus is both. Fully human, fully God. At the time when I was first studying this early church history, I was a campus pastor, regularly having conversations with university students about what they believed. And what I found fascinating was how many of the heresies of the early church were alive and well in the ideas of both Christians and non-Christians that I talked with. And over the years, I've realized how much of a challenge it is for me to relate to Jesus as if he is fully God and fully human, even though I believe it with my mind. In practice, I either get so used to Jesus' humanity that I diminish who I'm really talking to, or I get such a big picture of Jesus as God that I don't feel like I can approach him. My deepest moments of experiencing the love and grace of God is when the Spirit makes both real to me at the same time. When I remember that the Jesus who loves and understands me is the Lord of all, who made the heavens and the earth. And that is exactly where John brings us. A few reflections on what it means that the Word became flesh. First, when the Word became flesh, God became something new, something that he had never been before. In the beginning, the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But here, the Word became something that God had never been before. He became a part of the world he created. And he didn't just put on humanity like a person puts on a bathrobe, easily to put on and taken off once the job was done. No, Jesus the Word is still human right now, seated with God the Father. Jesus stands in solidarity with us in our humanity. We can never pass over the incredible dignity that this gives to us. In fact, John gives us the incredible picture of the greatness of Jesus as creator, as the one who has been with God from the beginning, so that we can really feel the contrast and therefore the incredible love behind Jesus' choice to become fully human. The one who made the stars became human. Fully human, just like us, born into an imperfect human family that lived in an imperfect and broken world. No one expected that God would do this, but he did. And surely this deepens our sense of worth as people. W.H. Auden is a poet, and he describes the birth of Jesus as the place where for once in our lives, everything became a you and nothing was an it. Everything made of matter mattered more when Jesus took on flesh. Each of us already had the incredible honor and privilege of being made in God's image, but now, knowing that God chose to become one of us, dignifies who and what we are. To be human is to be significant because God himself chose to be one of us. But God doesn't just tell us that the Word became flesh. He also tells us that he made his dwelling among us. A more literal translation of the text would be that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. The word tabernacle means dwelling place, so our English translations of the text are accurate, but the word tabernacle has a particular meaning in Jewish history. In the book of Exodus, God works through Moses to lead his people out of their life of slavery in Egypt. Once they are free, they have to learn how to be God's people. And one of the first things God does is to give Moses and the people instructions on how to build a tabernacle. This was to be a tent to be pitched in the very center of the camp with the 12 tribes of Israel surrounding it. This tent was to be God's dwelling place among his people. In fact, some of you may remember that in the book of Exodus, the Jewish people were led by a physical sign of God's presence with them, a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. I wish we had video footage of this. Wouldn't it be cool to see what this looked like? Because imagine what this was like. When Moses has the tabernacle ready, this is what Exodus tells us happened. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and the fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. If you read 1 Kings 8, you find that the same thing happens when the temple of God that Solomon built is dedicated to the Lord. The Spirit of God comes to be among his people, and the glory of God fills the temple. Happens again in Ezekiel 43. We have to keep these images in our minds if we're to rightly understand what John really means when he says, "We have seen his glory." The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. What's so amazing about this is that when Jesus came, there was no pillar of cloud or fire. There was a human being. And John is saying that he and the others who lived with Jesus day in and day out saw his humanity, in his humanity, something like the glory we read over and over again when people encounter the presence of God. They saw the glory of God in a person. When God's glory fills either the tabernacle or the temple, it's always too much for the people. They aren't able to enter the space filled with God's glory. And in Exodus 33, Moses actually asks God to show him his glory. And God essentially says to Moses, "You can't handle my front. You can only see my back." When the Word became flesh, those who were with Jesus were able to see his glory, and they were able to be close to him. Tom Wright points out that the Gospel of John doesn't include the transfiguration, which is probably the moment in Jesus' earthly life the most similar to the Old Testament revelations of God's glory. Tom suggests, though, that there is a sense in which John's whole story is about the transfiguration. He invites us to be still and know, to look again into the human face of Jesus of Nazareth until the awesome knowledge comes over us, wave upon terrifying wave, that we are looking into the human face of the living God. Eugene Peterson's translation of our passage in the Message is that the Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. Something powerful about the image of this God, the glory of God, as our neighbor. The thing about neighbors is that they're close, easy to get a hold of. This past summer, we had a toilet crack while we were away camping, and our next door neighbor is an incredibly kind plumber, and he helped my mother-in-law, who lives on our property, to find the source of the leak and turn the water off. Neighbors are close. The other thing about our neighbors is that they understand. They know what it's like to live in your building, your townhouse complex, your street. My neighbors know that watering is allowable till Saturdays at 9 a.m. And they know that there are a group of dogs on our street that howl anytime there's a siren or an alarm. If you look at the ancient religions of the world, the gods were never close. And there was no sense that they understood what it meant to be human. Until Jesus. We have no idea if prior to the incarnation, God knew what it felt like to be human. But now we know that God gets it. He understands fully and completely what it's like to be one of us because he has been and continues to be human. The God of the universe who fashioned the stars and holds the galaxies in his hands has drawn close to you. He has promised, in fact, to never leave or forsake you. He is closer than your neighbor. He understands what it's like to live in the world, what it's like to experience temptation and loss, sickness and pain. He knows what it's like to be grieve, what it's like to be angry. He knows what it's like to feel weak, what it's like to be afraid. I know I've gotten a bit heady lately, but hey, this is John 1, so I think I'm allowed to push you through a few mental gymnastics. But I don't want to end today without talking about the difference it makes that the Word has become flesh and dwelt among us. And I think it makes an incredible difference to us in our places of greatest need, particularly in our pain. Every religion has to address the problem of suffering and pain in the world. Read up on Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism. Each in their own way addresses the problem of suffering. In Christianity, the answer to the problem of suffering is the person of Jesus with us. When I journey with people through pain and suffering, most of the time I find myself not knowing what to say. And in the rare moments when I think I do know what to say, I should probably actually just be quiet. Because what can anyone say to another person in the midst of their pain? Despite knowing this, I find not knowing what to say to be uncomfortable. And I find myself wishing for answers, particularly because we believe that God is great, good, and loving, and has the capacity to do anything. Why didn't God? It's the cry of our hearts when we encounter pain and loss. And yet, I find the only answer I have most of the time is my presence, listening, asking questions, journeying alongside. And that is Jesus' answer as well. We know that ultimately, Jesus will come again and make things right, wiping away every tear and healing every hurt. Until then, though, we have Emmanuel, God with us, God with skin on, Jesus weeping with us, sustaining us, and loving us with empathy because he chose to get his hands dirty and become one of us. Sometimes we pray and God moves miraculously. Sometimes we don't pray and God still moves miraculously. And sometimes we pray and pray and pray and our circumstances do not change. It's not surprising in those moments that we ask our whys of God. I have a hunch, though, that if we really got the answer to all of our whys, we would find that they wouldn't feel much better. The answers wouldn't necessarily bring us the peace that we're looking for. And Jesus seldom gives us answers, but he always gives us himself. And that's ultimately what we need. We need the Word made flesh, dwelling with us, closer than our neighbor, than our spouse, than our dearest friend. John 1 begins with a cosmic vision of God, larger than galaxies, more powerful than stars. But he doesn't leave us there. And that's the glory and beauty and incredible power of what John is telling us, that when the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, God came close. Close enough to know us, close enough to be with us in our pain. God became more intimately involved in your life than the neighbor who dog sits for you or who comes over to borrow eggs. Sometimes we can feel like there isn't a lot of space for more difficult emotions at Christmas, because after all, it's the happiest time of the year, right? But take heart, because the Word became flesh to draw close to you, just as you are right now. And because he is human, he is in no way surprised about how you feel. So feel the freedom to be honest with Jesus and let him love you exactly where you are. Let him be Emmanuel to you. And as you let him love you, let your love for him grow in response, because he is worthy of our worship. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Oh, come, let us adore him, Christ the Lord.